Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. Tonight's episode of the Generation Y, I'll be interviewing a listener of ours who has a pretty sad and incredible story. I found it fascinating, and there's some things about it that I think everyone can learn something from. So, Samantha, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Samantha Collier. I live in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I have 3 children. They are 11, 9, and 2, and I definitely have a story that I've been bugging Justin about for a long time. There's bits and pieces, and you're always like, wow, that's crazy. So I figured it would be good to sort of put it all together, and I think that, you know, it's quite a crazy story, and, you know, there's a good side and a bad side and a guilty and a not guilty side, but I think that people can hear it and sort of learn from it and learn what not to do as a teenager, you know, or a young adult, and maybe not go through the same sort of thing that I went through.
So how does this all start? You meet a man, right?
Yes. So, but way back in the day, it was actually on my birthday, which is kind of funny because that ties into other things in the later events. It was my birthday, which was the fall of 2002. I worked at a jewelry store, and my girlfriend and I went out for dinner and then the bar to celebrate my birthday. And there was rum 151 shots involved, which I'll never forget. She wanted me to meet a few of her friends that were from Winnipeg. And I was like, okay, great, that's fine, because I like to party and do stuff. And the funny thing was is that when she met these people, she came back from Winnipeg with a tattoo on her back, and it was of, you know, this gang name, and it was very unlike her to do this. And I was like, well, you know, what is this? And she's like, well, it's, you know, it's a tattoo of this person's name that, you know, I met, and I thought that was really odd. So I was very intrigued to see who it was that she met. And so I went to a bar in Vancouver, and I saw a huge tall guy sort of across the crowd, and she said, oh, well, that's Beckham. Or no, she called him Kurt for Kirk, because he likes Star Trek. So I actually, when I first met him, I thought his name was Kurt. And he looked really mean, and I liked that at the time.
Kind of the bad boy thing
going. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was such a sucker for that. It was like the worse they were, the more I liked them, which is sort of a lesson from this, is not to go down that path, or not to marry them. You can hang out with them, but don't marry them and have kids with them. But I didn't really like him at first. I thought he was kind of, you know, stuck up and thought he was really cool. And I didn't really think that was that great. But then later on, we started talking and it was really funny because he wasn't just that tough guy. You know, like he actually had like substance to him. And he took like advanced calculus in school and he was like a Star Trek nerd. And he liked reading like science fiction books, really not what you would think a typical big tough guy would do. And I really liked that part of him. Like I liked the, you know, that he looked a certain way, but he also had sort of a cool backside. I mean, we used to play World of Warcraft together. Like we were total nerds as well. I remember thinking that I was actually going to marry him, which was not like me at all. Like I was never that quick to think something, but I just kind of knew that we had this this bond. And, you know, he had been working before as a miner in Thompson, Manitoba. He's from Thompson, which is 800 kilometers north of Winnipeg. He's Albanian. His parents were from Albania. They moved here, which is this very different culture than, you know, other cultures. Even in Canada, where we have every culture, I'd never met anyone who was Albanian before. And I think that was a struggle for him growing up. He never quite fit in with anybody. His parents didn't really let him grow up being Canadian per se. Like he was always kind of forced to be Albanian. They didn't give him money. They didn't give him anything. So he kind of struggled a lot.
He was struggling and his parents were not really.
Yeah, like they didn't give him anything at all. They didn't give them money. I mean,
and they wouldn't let him acclimate to the culture either.
Not at all. And a funny story with that is Beckham's brother actually, they kept money in the house. They didn't believe in banks at all. So they kept all their money in the house. And one time his brother at 12 stole all the money and ran away with the fare. Like, I think he spent like $20,000.
Oh my gosh.
And it was, it's cause there's a lot of little stories like that. But the basis of it is he was, like you said, he was struggling to always fit in. So I think he felt this need to have money, first of all, because he didn't have any growing up. And then, you know, to have girlfriends because he never really had girlfriends. He was kind of awkward. And so he kind of had this like drive in him to fit in and then to like kind of like stick it to the man, you know, so to say. Like he was always trying to fit in with people. But later on in life, I mean, it was the complete opposite. Like everyone wanted to be around him. Everyone I know that knows him is like, there's nobody else in the world like him, which there really isn't. Like, I've never met anyone like him again, but that's also because I was married to him.
Yeah.
And I can say that. But to go back to the story is when he came here, I didn't really know at the time, but he actually afterwards had a warrant out for his arrest. He got caught in Vancouver with a bunch of money, and they arrested him and sent him back to Winnipeg, and he got put into jail. You know,
what's illegal about having money?
I know, right? So the backstory of that is he was a drug dealer in Winnipeg, and they were always trying to catch him, you know, with something. They couldn't catch him with drugs. They never did. They never caught him, you know, actually committing that crime. So what it is in Vancouver, and I don't know if it's the same or in Canada, it's proceeds of crime. So if they can catch you with money and you can't prove where it came from, you know, you don't have a receipt, there's no one, you know, you didn't get it from work, they can charge you with that. They can put you in jail right away and just sort of hold you. I mean, I guess it's based on your past. I mean, he really got screwed when it's about jail and court. I mean, like, people in Canada, they commit murder and they get 2 years in jail. But if you get charged with conspiracy to traffic, you'll get like 6 years in jail. So it's very strange. Like that guy who killed the guy on the Greyhound bus. I mean, he's out.
Yeah, he got out after a year.
Right? And that's like, that to me is insane that that happened. I mean, I understand it being mental and he has mental problems, but I always think, you know, what if he didn't take his medication? That would be pretty.
Yeah. It's an extreme case. Yeah.
Right? He went to Winnipeg. I used to fly back and forth between Vancouver and Winnipeg because me being the idiot I was like, yo, you know, it's fine. It's not a big deal. He's not really that bad. You know, like, it was fun. You know,
you never see the red flags.
Right? Like, I didn't see them. And he had nice cars and he had status, I guess. And I don't know. There was just this feeling I had with him. And I knew bad guys before, so it wasn't like because he was bad, but I just loved him. You know, it almost brings tears to my eyes now, which is really sad. But like when I get off the plane to go, I'd be so nervous, you know, but it was like that good nervous, like when you're so happy to see someone that you just can't even contain it. Like I would fly there on a Saturday, hang out with them for a Saturday night, and I would fly home on Sunday morning. And that's like a 5-hour flight.
That's a long flight.
Right? Like it was crazy, but I did it. I dug myself into debt with it, but it was nuts. And so, you know, fast forward a few months, 4 months after in February, I actually found out I was pregnant with my first child. I remember I was mortified. I was like, "Oh God, this is going to be crazy and he's going to be like, oh, it's not mine." You know, like typical, like I didn't think he'd want a kid, right, at all. And I remember I paged him. I think it was pagers and stuff. And I'm like, oh, God, you have to call me. You have to call me. And I told him. And he's like, if you don't want it, will you have it and give it to me? He wanted to be a dad so badly. And it was so it was shocking to me that he was like that. And I mean, I was overjoyed, right? I was like over the moon. I was so happy. And we were going to have my son, who's now 11, when I was 5 months pregnant, he got arrested again. And this time it was in Winnipeg. And from that point on, he was in jail for 2 years, wow. 2.5 years. So I had my son when he was in jail. His brother was in and out of jail at the time, who was coming back and forth between Vancouver and Winnipeg. He was in jail for a conspiracy to traffic cocaine, and they had money evidence, and they had, you know, I think a few people's testimony, but they were all kind of shady people. And then in Vancouver, if you get caught with drugs, it's a pretty bad charge, but you're not really like, you know, you're not really like put in jail and like have the book thrown at you. He was put into solitary confinement for 1.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so he would sleep with a towel over his head because he couldn't, they never turned the lights off. I could send him books, but I sent him like every single book that was ever written, like science fiction kind of based. And he was never the same after that. He went on to antidepressants in jail. He probably gained about 50 pounds. Like when he got out of jail, I didn't even recognize him hardly. He was so big. He became very, very bitter, you know, towards the system, I guess. And he really wasn't given a chance to get, you know, they always say you're rehabilitated in jail, but you're not. He was put into solitary confinement because, not because of anything bad, because they said that he controlled the jail. They said that people would listen to him instead of listening to the guards. So like if he stayed out of like they called it a range, you know, if you're in kind of groups in a jail, so there's different floors, and he was on a certain floor, and they tell you to lock up. And if he didn't, like, walk to his room, everyone else would stay out too. And then if he walked into his room, they would all walk into their room. So he was really, people looked up to him quite a lot.
Wow.
It wasn't his fault. He didn't do anything to have that happen. Like, he did do some crimes, but he wasn't this violent, you know, person.
It's the street credibility he brought in with him.
That's exactly it. I mean, I was scared to go there. Like, after I had my son, I wouldn't fly there because I saw the way he got treated, and I saw how they kind of twisted things that I thought, if I took my son there, you know, maybe they're going to try and do something to take my son away or cause me some problems or cause me grief. And I didn't. I didn't go. Like, the first time he met my son, we were sitting in a courthouse in the hallway, and they used to bring people down the middle of the hall in shackles, and he had the typical black and white striped you know, like jail outfit on, and he touched my son's hands with his hands. Like he kind of bent down a bit and touched them. And that was how we met him. I don't think he shouldn't have been in jail. Like he was charged with something. I agree that he should have been in jail or, you know, waiting for his hearing. But it was the way they treated him in jail that was pretty brutal. Like there was always something more without him getting in trouble. Like in Canada, you can get out in 2/3 of your sentence. And if you're, you know, good, I guess. He didn't get out in 2/3. Like, he served almost his full sentence.
They considered him dangerous and not rehabilitated.
Yeah, and I mean, they count every day before your actual sentence as 2 days. You know, so the time waiting till he got convicted was double time. Mm-hmm. So he didn't do the full, like, he got convicted and charged. He got charged with the conspiracy to traffic. He got found guilty, and he got 6 years. In jail for that. And I forget how much time he had time served, but he ended up doing about 2.5 to 3 years total from the time he went to the time he got out. The person he was before versus the person he was after was night and day.
It made him worse.
Way worse. Like the moment he got out, I mean, I was like so happy to see him, right? Mm-hmm. He came over and we like went for coffee. Or I went to meet him in Winnipeg. We went for coffee. I was going to live there with him because I thought he was going to be better. The first thing he did was went and hung out with 20 guys that he had a no contact order with. I was like, really? Like you, like I'm with my kid and now you're going, and he just didn't care. And I'm like, you've been in jail for 2.5 years. The first thing in his mind was he dealt drugs in Western Canada. So between Winnipeg and Vancouver, I wouldn't say he controlled it, but he had a very large say in sort of what happened. And when he was in jail, you know, he lost control of that. And there was a biker gang that gained control of that.
Yeah, there's the vacuum, the void that needs to be filled.
And that's it. Like they always say, like if they like arrest a huge kingpin of a drug thing, they're always like, oh, we got this guy, but it's like there's three other guys that are going to come up and take that exact same place. Like that doesn't solve the problem with it. Basically, another crazy thing that happened was I got pregnant with my daughter the moment he got out of jail. Oh. So you know, they say that if you smoke pot, you know, your sperm count goes down. Well, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. The amount of things that are in jail, it's crazy. Like, he smoked pot in jail. He had food delivered to him in jail from the guards in the jail.
He had anything, access.
Right? Like, anything. Like, East Indian food. He loved that. He got it all the time. I think they had cell phones in there. So
Not like American prisons at all.
Really? Is that like American prisons?
No, it's nothing like American prisons.
Really?
No. American prisons, you can't, there is drug transactions, but getting cell phones and guards to bring you food, no, that doesn't
matter. They just threw it over the fence there. Like it was a maximum security penitentiary. Mm-hmm. And I saw the place, so I don't understand how it happened. But I met guards in there that were his friends and that called me and that would bring him stuff. I think what it is that if they get offered a certain amount of money, I mean, they're making a certain amount, and it's not all of them by any means, you know, it's just a few that they'll do it. It wasn't like they were being bad. The guards that I knew weren't the ones bringing in drugs or anything, but they would give him food or give him, like, you know, put stuff in his fridge. And he had a full flat screen TV. He could wear any clothes he wanted. It was not like a jail. Like it was very lax. Winnipeg jails are definitely way tougher than, like, or I used to just say Eastern Canada jails are like more tougher than BC jails. And the time that you get sentenced is more as well. I mean, it's nothing compared to the US, but it's very different. I mean, I wouldn't want to be wrongly charged in the U.S. because, I mean, you could really get a lot of time. But
what podcast have you been listening to that gives you that idea?
I know. So, I mean, to summarize what happened is he got out of jail and he wanted to take control back of the drug trade, and he wasn't getting it, and he was desperate. He was borrowing money and losing it. He was trying everything he could to get it back, and the gang that had it was not interested, you know, in any shape or form by letting him get it back. And during this time, I mean, they were pretty pissed off at him, right? They were threatening his life, but he really didn't give a shit. Like, he, well, whatever. He, I used to tell him to stop, you know, it doesn't matter who you are or how big you are. I mean, he was like 6'5" and like 260 pounds, and he just thought he was the toughest thing. And I said, it just takes a bullet, right?
Yeah.
To get you. It, and people that are scared of you are more likely to kill you because they're scared. He, of course, oh, no, it's fine. And I really didn't think it was that big of a deal at that time. I didn't really know to the extent of what it was he was doing, because we lived in our house. Nothing was around us. And, you know, I had my daughter during that time, and he wasn't around. Like, I can't say that I didn't know what was going on, because I did.
But the home environment seemed normal.
Yeah, it stopped. And I'll tell you what happened. But it was we had our own little life going. We live in a really nice area of Vancouver. And I mean, I started to work, and, you know, it was just not around us. But there was a night, it was in January of 2007. I was sleeping. My daughter was 4 months old, I think. And we had a neighbor who lived downstairs, and she smoked pot. So of course, Beckham and her like loved each other, and they kept the door unlocked between our places. All I remember is her coming to the bedroom and waking me up and saying, don't move fast. I was like, what? She's like, don't move fast. Come downstairs. And I was, okay. So I went downstairs, and there was two guys at our door, our front door. And they were like, we're here to see Beckham. And I said, well, he's not here right now. You know, why don't you come back later on? Well, no, we're here to see him. And I was like, well, no, he's not here. And if anything I learned from him was like not to let anyone in, right? And there was nothing in her house that I knew of, but I just didn't want to. I was scared of what Beckham would think, you know, if I let them in. I was scared of them. I was just really freaked out about the whole thing. Well, they pushed me aside, and they came running into the house. It was a full, we call it the ERT team, but it's like a SWAT team. And they ran up my stairs with guns and everything.
They were so these were law enforcement.
Yes. Yep. They had our whole street blocked off, the alley blocked off in the back. My neighbors were told to get on the ground and get back into their house. They thought that I had been murdered because they didn't understand, because they didn't know what was happening.
They just see tons of police cars.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. And I run up the stairs because my kids are sleeping in the room, and I'm yelling at them that, you know, I don't want them to wake up and be scared. And they did stop, and they did just look in the room. So they didn't wake them up. They didn't cause, you know, a big thing. And thank God they actually stayed sleeping. I don't even remember what I was thinking, but I was just, I didn't know what to think at the time. I called Beckham and I said, you know, you've got to come home. Like, I don't know what's happening. And he got on the phone with the head, I guess the guy, the head cop. He basically made them promise that they weren't going to arrest him, you know, like if he came home. They said they just wanted to talk to him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was in a pretty bad spot, though, because, like, we were at home, and he wouldn't want to come home, but it was us, yeah. So we kind of had to come home. Well, he pulled up in his, like, nice Lexus, and the first thing they do is pick him up out of his car and throw him on the ground, right? And there's six officers holding him down. He's yelling at me from the road that I'm a fucking bitch and I shouldn't have let them in. And I'm yelling at him, you know, saying I didn't. And so we were like yelling at each other, and the police had to actually bring me inside. Later on, he found out that I didn't, and he was like, oh yeah, you're down, you're cool. I was like, yeah, whatever.
But like it mattered, you know, exactly. like that logic had anything.
No,
but
again. I know, it was so traumatic that I don't even know what I was really thinking. But
well, something else is that when people get in trouble, they don't like to blame themselves. They immediately want to blame somebody else for their troubles. And after his stint in prison and everything else, he's really deflecting all his anger onto other people.
Oh yeah. And that was him. I mean, he never took responsibility for what he did. like we were constantly fighting about, you know, that he should stop. And but I kind of understood where he was coming from, is that he was at that point, he was about 32. I mean, he hadn't worked for a long time. He owed all this money, a lot of money, right? Like a lot of money. And there, the people that he owed money to, they weren't going to be like, oh, well, okay, you know, you don't owe us money anymore. Like, he was in this very hard place. And yes, he could have stopped. But when you're in that life, I mean, Canada is pretty small when it comes to that stuff. You can't really just go away, right? Like, I still, to this day, people come up to me and they remember me from that. And it's frustrating because I don't really want to be remembered, you know, in that. But I could see his logic as to why he didn't stop. I didn't agree with it, but I could see how he was kind of stuck. It was also the power. I think it's really, it's something that people get addicted to, you know, like people walking up to you and looking up to you and having all this money. And it's like a drug.
The thrill.
Right? Yeah. And he could buy whatever he wanted, you know, tipping a waiter like $100, $200. Like, he liked to be seen as that guy.
Yeah. Most drug dealers, and when they can tip $100 to a waiter or waitress, they feel like Robin Hood.
Exactly. And he did. You know, the funniest thing about him, the people that worked for him were all kind of nerdy, but they weren't like the big other tough guys. Like, they were guys, you know, had a hard time growing up or were kind of dorky when they were younger. And I think he kind of saw himself in that, you know, and he felt bad for them. He would, you know, stick up for them. And in his own way, he felt for them. What led to his demise really is that he wasn't tough enough to go and really beat up or kill people, that the ones that wanted to do it to him. Like, yes, he did do some violent things, but when it came down to it, he wouldn't kill someone, right? Mm-hmm. Where he was playing with people that would.
Absolutely would.
Oh, the whole point of that was the police told me they came to warn him that there was a funeral in Vancouver. It was like a biker funeral, and these people were flying in from all over the country, and they wanted to warn him that these people wanted to kill him. How does that mean you bring an ERT team to my house? I don't get it. They're like, well, we had to make sure that they weren't in the house. You know, and they found a joint, and they charged him with trafficking. Yeah. Trafficking, yeah. For a joint. You know, like, it just shows that they can do, if they have to do, find a reason, you know, to arrest someone, they can. And then like a couple hours later, they're like, well, we need to get a warrant to search the house after they've already searched the house. Really? You have to get a warrant now? And they left a couple police officers in the house, and the police and I like ordered pizza, hung out and talked.
Only in Canada.
Right. And they were super funny. And I went to work the next morning. I took the kids to their daycare. At that moment, for me, the bubble was popped, right? I knew that there was much more going on, and I moved out. Mm-hmm. So I took the kids and I went into like basically like government housing. I mean, we went from living in like a really nice place and I had these nice cars to living pretty, not lavishly whatsoever.
Not to pick on you, but you've seen him in jail. You've seen him at his worst, yet having police come to your home and seeing him face down in the street was the bubble point for you, it sounds.
Yeah,
like.
I know. It's crazy that, I don't know if it's like what love does to you or being immature. I was very childish. Now that I look back, I was just completely blinded. When you're outside looking in, what the hell? Like, my friends sat down with me and were like, what are you doing? My family sat down with me, and I don't know if it was having kids, you know, because I was pregnant for like half the time we were together. Even my doctors, you know, what's going on? And I think I was ignorant to it. But when that happened, it was in my face then, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I've never been arrested. I don't have a criminal record. I've never done anything criminal. I guess I thought that if I was like that and I didn't see what he did, then I was separate. But then when that happened, I knew, you know, and the police were calling me after that. Every 3 or 4 days, they'd call me because they knew that I was close with him. I don't, you know, they didn't even know he was married when he died. like they apologized afterwards for not calling me right away. But
well, spoiler alert, let's get to that point.
Yeah. So long story short, he had to go up to Thompson because he was dealing drugs there, and you know, other people were not paying him what they should pay, and they were kind of messing around. So he went there, and that was in December of 2007. On December 7th, he was shot and murdered. He was shot and murdered by not someone who was in the biker gang, but he was the brother of someone who was in the biker gang. And
an acquaintance, an associate.
This gets really confusing, so I wish I could like draw this out. The person who killed Beckham, his name was Sean. Sean's brother was charged with conspiracy to murder for his own brother.
And Sean was charged with murder.
Yeah, so Sean was the one that killed Beckham.
The
trigger
man.
He was charged with first degree murder, and he got found guilty. Sean's own brother was actually convicted of conspiracy to commit murder to kill Sean.
To kill Sean, not...
Yes.
Not, okay, yes. Weird.
I know. So the backstory of that is that a lot of people wanted to kill Beckham, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot. And so the police had an informant who was working on this whole other undercover operation called Project Drill. So during that operation, this informant was talking to these other people, and he was listening to them say they wanted to kill Beckham and they wanted to kill Sean. And so they would kill Beckham for $20,000 and kill Sean for $2,000. That guy heard that conversation on December 5th. So the police knew that these people wanted to kill him and were going to be doing it, you know, within that next 3 or 4 days. It came out later on that they did know about it. And I was pretty devastated that they knew and didn't warn him, because I know that if they would have warned him at that time, he wouldn't be alone in a house. Because what happened is he was sitting on a computer in a house by himself. It was sort of like a townhouse, right? So they kicked the door open and they ran in, and he had a table and he flew it, like he kind of kicked it up in the air. But then he fell backwards over another table and he died. But I know that he wouldn't have been alone in a house at that time if he knew that was going to happen.
Well, and it's sort of funny that they came and raided your home to warn him of a funeral, but then they have a confirmed hit on him.
Yeah.
No warning.
So yeah, that's what I brought up, because I had been pretty close with them at the time, and I called the detective on the case because I read it in the newspaper. That's how I found out that they knew this was going to, and they didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but they knew that, you know, something was kind of brewing. And I called them and I was pretty upset. And they said, well, you know, Samantha, like a lot of people wanted to kill your husband. And if we were going to warn him every single time, we would be warning him every month. That's... And I kind of understand that, you know, a bit. Like, I don't think that they were blatantly trying to get him murdered. He was a drug dealer. So it wasn't like he was just walking down the street. He was kind of contributing to his own demise.
Well, he was absolutely living a high-risk lifestyle.
And he would say that himself.
Yeah.
The weirdest part was, is I actually, you know, we were not seeing each other a lot at that point, like maybe every month or so. He wasn't seeing the kids. And
you were kind of separated at that point.
Yeah, like we were separated, but I definitely was still in love with him. Mm-hmm. Like I was not seeing anybody else. He was out partying everywhere. People would call me and say, oh, they saw him here and they saw him there. But I still didn't care. Like I said, it was like almost blinded. Like I just loved him. I would yell at him and get mad about things, but would still like take him back. And by taking him back, I mean like I'd see him maybe once a month. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd come over. But when he came over to where we lived, he wouldn't have anyone with him. We would just be us.
He would drop the facade of I'm a big drug dealer and I'm now just your husband.
Yes. We would be so nerdy together. We would play World of Warcraft during that time. You know, we watched Donnie Darko and we would talk about all the weird things that are like rabbits in the wallpaper in the movie, you know, like these very strange conspiracies. And that was the part of him that I loved. I remember him looking at her daughter and he was crying. I could die. I've had a son and a daughter, and I could die happy.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
And he said that like a week before he died. I actually flew up to Thompson about 4 days before he was murdered. Now, I would never do that, but I don't know, something... And like, I'm not like a spiritual or like, you know, believe in like weird coincidences, but something was like, you need to go.
You had an intuition.
Yeah. And I went, and it was this weird thing. We told each other all these things we never told each other. I was really honest with him about a bunch of other things, and it was just different. And I remember hugging him. This is so sappy, but I remember hugging him and feeling like he wasn't there. And this is going to make me cry. And I remember looking at him from the back, and I can see his hair, like, you know, on the back of your head, the way your hair grows, mm-hmm. like in a little swirl. And I remember looking at it, and I was, wow, like, he's just a person. He's doing all this stuff, but like, I love him so much that I love the way his hair grows, you know? And I never thought of it that way. And then he drove me to the airport. And he got up at 5 a.m. to drive me to go back to Vancouver. And he never got up early, like never. Like even when I was pregnant, like I used to like have to do things. He would never, ever, ever do that. And he drove me to the airport. He came in with me. And I remember he left. And I never turned around. Like, you know, when you watch someone leave. Mm-hmm. Like, I never had turned around and watched someone leave, but I turned around and I watched him go, and I watched him go into like the light. It was really weird, but it was really light outside and it was really dark in the airport. And I remember him walking away, and I just had this feeling when it happened. They always say that you would feel something if like your husband died or your wife died, like you'd somehow know. Well, I didn't know. Like, I figured it out that I was shopping at Walmart. Right when the time when he died, because of the time difference, like he was in Winnipeg and I was in Vancouver, and it was when you had MSN, you know, like Messenger, instant yeah. Messenger.
Yeah, I remember that.
We were talking, and it was about 6 or 7 or whatever. I went out and I came back, and I could see that he was still online but away, and I started writing him, and he was ignoring me, and I was really pissed off, and I was like, "What the hell are you doing?" And then the next morning, his mom called me and was like, Beckham's gone. Oh, like he's flying back. And she's like, no, he's dead. It was, there's nothing in this world that can, like, there's nothing that's as bad as that. And I, like, didn't believe them. I didn't believe her. And I called the hospital, and they said, oh, no, he's not here. We would know about this if this happened. Don't worry about it. Like, call the police. So I called the police in Thompson, and no one answered the phone. What? Like, no one's answering the phone there? And it got rerouted to Winnipeg. I asked them what happened, and they're like, oh, we can't talk about it. Like, we'll call you back. 2 hours later, they called. And that was, like, the official phone call. And then I had to fly there to talk to detectives about it. And I don't remember any of it. Like, it was such a haze to me. I have to say that the police that were involved with it actually did a really good job. There are so many people and so many drug dealers that get killed. And I hear it all the time. And I agree that, like, they bring it on themselves. It's weird. It's like you don't think they should get this big murder investigation, but they really were people,
and
too.
And they have loved ones, such as yourself. They have children.
That was the thing. Like, I would talk to them, and they actually did such a good job. And they said that even though Beckham was he was doing that, he was always funny with them. He wasn't being violent. He would joke around with them. He actually wanted to be a police officer, which is quite ironic, you know. And
exactly.
Right? He wanted to do it, but I forget for some reason. I think he couldn't for some reason. And they liked him. You know, he was charming. He knew how to talk to everybody, and he knew how to – everyone liked him. You know, like, I still get messages to this day. Like, on Facebook, I got a message a few days ago that were like, oh, I knew your husband. And he just had that charisma. Like, if he would have chosen to use that towards a different life, different job, he would have been amazing, right? But it was like this perfect storm of bad choices and bad situations and meeting the right bad people that led to this whole thing. So the police actually did a really good job. They couldn't tell me a lot about what happened because I didn't know where he'd been shot or, like, what kind of gun was used. And they said that they couldn't tell me that information because they were waiting to see if they heard it from somewhere else to see if it was right or not.
A vetting process. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was really hard for me because I didn't know what happened. And then these rumors started going around that he was shot in the head. Like, people, they made him bend on his knees and, you know, like, execution style. And people would call me and tell me that. There was girls that would call me and say that I should be dead and buried next to him. It was so horrifying at what people can say, you know, like, what they can do. And a person that was involved with it called me the next day and was crying their eyes out. This guy, this is someone he'd gone to school with, someone that he was, like, born with, basically. And he was the one that ended up driving the people there. And he was saying, you know, I'm going to give you stuff for the rest of your life. I'm going to help your kids. I'm going to do all, when he had been involved.
Wow.
Right? And I remember he was crying harder than me. And I was like, wait, like, everyone else, I was the one upset, you know, and they were consoling me. But with him, I was consoling him.
Yeah, I mean, one, he feels so guilty about his actions, but his actions were what absolutely contributed to.
But I feel for him. Like, to this day, he left. Basically, that night, he took off, and the police put him in, like, witness protection program or whatever Canada's version of it. I think what happened is that he was working with Beckham at the time, and he owed Beckham money, and Beckham went there to, like, beat him up. And then the other side, I guess, like, the side that killed him, went to him and said, you know, we'll help you, but you have to show us where he is. Like, you have to basically help us kill him. And he was in this bad place. Mm-hmm. He didn't quite know what to do. And so...
And he might not have believed that they were going to go kill him either, because that's a pretty extreme action that most of us don't kind of accept readily.
And he was the one that found him. I mean, I don't know if found him is the right word, but he was the one that called the police. It was in his house. Well, I talked to him and it was so bad, but I wanted to know like details, like graphic details of what happened. And
people will wonder why, but
it's weird. It's with your kid, like anyone else, you picture them dead. You don't want to see them.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to know, but with him, I wanted to know because I wanted to know exactly what he was thinking, like what he felt. Especially when people were telling me that he was like executed and like made to bend over and do this stuff. And he said, no, you know, he was lying on the ground and his eyes were closed and there was no blood. Like there was hardly any blood. And they said that that was because they shot him in the heart and he basically died instantly. So the blood like stopped, I guess, pumping. So it wouldn't come out.
Yeah, it wouldn't circulate. Know?
Yeah. And so that kind of gave me peace, right? That he didn't suffer. And I always think the last thing he would have thought is he would have known that his kids were okay. Because I was always the one trying to like make sure they had a good life. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was always trying to, I always thought like I could keep them away from it. But on one hand, like I've kept them away, but now they have to deal with this like the rest of their life too. And it makes me feel horrible, right? That I have to have this story, you know, to tell them about their dad. But on the other hand, they'll never see that bad side.
Well, and when you meet strangers and they ask you, where's their daddy? Do you feel ashamed sometimes?
Yes, absolutely. Like even like talking about it now, like we've said, like it's very shameful to me now because like, I work in a whole different field, right? Like I work in social media in the legal industry. You're
very, very professional field.
Yeah. And people hear it and they're like, what? Like you, this happened to you? And I think it's because after this happened, it was like rock bottom to me. And I worked so hard to get it away. You know, like I had all this debt. I had leased cars, you know, in my name. I had a house and I had to go around to leasing companies and like beg them to like not make me owe this much money. His cars, like he had a BMW parked at the airport and then like another car and all these places I had to go around and get them. And I had to do it all myself because all his friends, and I say that in quotes, his friends, they all left.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if he would have been like, see, I told you everyone's out for themselves, or he would have been shocked, but it's kind of good that they did leave. It was really a learning experience, right? Like of what not to do, how these things can affect you down the line. You go out and you like, especially with girls, and I don't know if it's like this everywhere, but in Vancouver growing up, there's so many people that are involved in this lifestyle, you know, it becomes very normal almost. Even where I grew up, which was like a rich area, guys started doing it. They started dealing like when they didn't have to.
It's such a shock to me because the stereotype of Canada is everybody's happy and waving to each other and very nice. No. And the culture's very and you don't hear about the darker side until somebody tells you a story like this.
I think it's very easy. And the reason is because of our criminal system too. I mean, like, yeah, he got a bunch of time, but you don't get a lot of time for things. Like they used to say, if you get found with like 2 pounds of bud, you'll be out of jail by the time your next crop comes up.
Uh-huh.
Right. It's not that bad.
So what happened to the man accused of murder?
Yeah. So the guy who did it, he was actually charged with murder before. He got 10 years for killing the wrong twin.
This is a previous situation where he had killed somebody, a twin, and he picked the wrong one.
Yeah.
Wow.
He picked the wrong one, killed him, and he did 10 years. I don't think he did 10 years. He got 10 years life, which in Canada just means that you'll be like on parole for the rest of your life, right? It doesn't mean that you do life. And so he got 10 years. He got out. He started doing drugs, and I think he owed Becca money at the time. And They haven't convicted anyone else, but I know there's other people involved. But with him, he was the only one. They found a bunch of evidence, but they actually arrested him on my birthday a year after.
Happy birthday.
I know. It was funny that I met Beckham on my birthday too. Right. So it was just odd.
So they didn't have any suspects for a year, or they didn't?
I think they had suspects, but they wanted to have a rock solid case is what they told me. Mm-hmm. Like they wanted to make sure that they said that they don't arrest people lightly. They don't want to arrest someone unless they actually are going to convict him.
Did you cooperate with the law enforcement?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I told them everything. Like I was calling them. I was like doing my own work. You know me.
Yeah.
Like I was like searching things on the internet.
You're
like
very diligent.
I was doing everything I could to try and figure it. I was calling people there. He got a tattoo of a teardrop after he did it, which I don't know if people know, but like that's like a gang thing of after you kill someone, you get a tattoo teardrop on your face. And even the judge said in her ruling, you got a tattoo of a teardrop on your face after you did it.
You just branded yourself guilty.
Yeah. And he got shot in that time. Like he killed Beckham in December. He got shot in a drive-by in, I think, in the summer after. And the police called me. I think they wanted to see if maybe Beckham's brother was involved, but his brother was in jail at the time. And I mean, they called me like, oh, Sean's been in a drive-by. I was like, really? Like, I was almost happy. And now I'm not. But I was like, well, he kind of experienced everything he put Beckham through, too. He was shot. And he kind of got, like, not paralyzed, but he's got some medical problem now with his legs. And then he got arrested for this maybe 3 months later. And then he got convicted. And now he's trying to appeal his case as well.
How did the trial go against him? Was there anything in there that sticks out to you?
No, I think what happened is I think they found it was a glass shards from the table that Beckham flipped over. They found in his shoes. And then there was like a cigarette butt or something that was flipped. And then there was also gunpowder residue on his hands. And I remember that happened. I think they knew that right from the get-go. There was something they had to like show, or they had to do other things. But it was a pretty rock-solid case. And I had faith that it would be. Like, I knew that if they actually did arrest him, that he would be found guilty. And even when the police called me to tell me that they arrested him, like, they were in tears. They were so happy. Because I had been calling them, and I had always been working hard to make sure that they saw Beckham as a person, not just this drug dealer, like that he had, you know, a family and he had all this stuff. And it's confusing for me because, like, on one hand, it's like I think of him like this person, but then I struggle with, well, he also did all this bad stuff. So why do you advocate for him so much if he did all this?
You're advocating for humanity.
Yeah. It's the fairness, I think, right? It's because I see who he was besides that. You know, like I know his family and a bunch of his friends and like people that aren't involved. And I mean, his mom was devastated and how it's affected her life and everyone's life. I think that if I do this enough, maybe I could help it in some way not happen. I don't think I could stop a drug dealer from dealing because they're stuck in that life, but maybe stopping someone from getting involved the way I did. Or
I wanted you to talk about the guy who his charges and what he was sentenced and how he's serving out his sentence in prison.
So the funny thing is that Beckham had used almost every good criminal lawyer in Winnipeg. So there was a conflict of interest with Sean getting a lawyer at the time.
Okay.
And Sean would not accept legal aid because it was a murder case and he didn't want a bad lawyer. But every single good lawyer was taken, basically, like, or he couldn't use. The case got delayed like a whole bunch of times because he also was trying to represent himself. And the judge was like, no, you can't, because this is like a very complicated case. Like, I think it was one of the longest murder trials. The details of the case had to be looked at from like the top courts in Canada to decide, you know, whether he could, it was how he was going to be represented. Like if they could force him to get legal aid or not. And I think he was trying to find a loophole somehow, you know, so that he could get out. Sean was convicted of first-degree murder, and he had a co-accused named Kevin, who was facing a charge of manslaughter. He was acquitted because they didn't have enough evidence against Kevin. And I didn't really know who Kevin was. And I hated him just because he was involved, right? But I didn't know sort of what he was doing. And the weird part was I would actually look all these people up on Facebook while it was going on, you know, and I'd see that like, oh, Kevin got married and he has a baby now. Oh, Sean has a girlfriend and, you know, he's got four kids. And I would see their lives continuing to go on. It made me furious. And now Sean still has a Facebook account.
This is the man in prison for the murder of your husband.
Yeah.
And he still has a Facebook account.
Yes. And it has like his address on where to write him. It's very surreal. Like they're like typical jail photos, you know, like all like tough looking, and you can see the tattoo of the teardrop in his eye. When I was very, very mad and twisted, and I used to like add him as a friend and see if he'd add me, but he won't, right? And like send him messages, and he is a no contact with me, I believe, so he can't respond to me or talk to me, which I'm sure he doesn't want to.
But you're just poking the hornet's nest.
I do. I do. I'm a lot better now, but I did. I was the wave of emotions you go through, right? Like from anger to ashamed to, well, fuck everything. Like I'm still mad. Like they say grief is like six stages. Mm-hmm. You go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then there's like no stage. It's so weird. Like everyone used to say, well, time heals everything. And I'd be like, well, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like time does not. In hindsight, it does. I used to wish that like 2 years would just go by, because then I knew I'd be better after that.
If you sat in solitary confinement for 2 years, I don't think you'd be better. It's the lessons and experiences over that 2 years that really make the difference, I think.
Yeah. And meeting people too that have had similar situations, and what you've said is like not being ashamed of it. I think it's, I've only had maybe two or three times where I actually did feel shame, but they say that you'll always remember the bad times, right? Where someone looked down on you, instead of the like 99 times where someone might have like identified with you. Mm-hmm. He also has children, like he has four kids. Mm-hmm. And I still looked them up because I'm a creep. And they're, you know, they have their separate lives too, and I don't hate them. No. You know, I used to be pretty bitter towards him and towards everyone, but I think that he was on drugs at the time as well. And it really could have been the other way. Like if Beckham were to be serving 25 years for life or for killing someone versus being dead, you know, what would I rather have? It's up to him now to forgive himself or to do whatever he needs. I don't hate him anymore. And it took me about 5 years to be at that point.
Well, it's just not much to hate anymore.
Exactly. Exactly.
What was he sentenced to?
Oh, he was sentenced to 25 years life sentence, which is the longest sentence you can get in Canada.
So this is the second murder he's been convicted of, and he's getting 25 to life.
Yeah, well, 25 total. But what happens is at 25 years, he'll go up for parole. And unless he's done something really bad, you know, he's going to get out. You know, and I think he's about 45 now. He'll be out, you know, when he's maybe 60. He's going to be free, right? Which I mean, when I look at the American system, I think, well, if he would have been doing 25 years for the first murder, this probably wouldn't have happened. Maybe Beckham could have been killed from someone else, but this exact circumstance like wouldn't have happened. If he were to get out and commit another violent crime, he could be deemed a dangerous offender. there's like some serial killers in Canada. And the funny thing is I listened to your story about Willie Picton.
Yeah.
And Beckham's brother was in jail next to him.
Oh, small world.
I know. And you said that he was like a little slimy, like little person that would like cower in the corner of the cell, like away from the guards and everyone and everything. And so, yeah, I think he's appealed the case and he's waiting to get another appeal. But I think he's pretty much done.
Do you know what he's trying to appeal on?
No, I don't know the actual aspect of the case because I know they have to find an error in the previous judge's ruling or something. I don't know what it is. But what I've been told from lawyers is that you can almost always find something. There's always like a little detail or a little thing that you can sort of misconstrue or say that the judge didn't really, you know, do the right thing. So
I just hope that you can stop feeling ashamed.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten better. I think it's like coming on here is a big deal for me. Even after it happened, I worked at a firm where the people, like the partners there, told me never to talk about it because it would make them look bad to them. And I was quoted like from Facebook, you know, in the papers. They were worried that it would come on to them. And so I guess the people were so shocked that it happened that I was so worried I'd be looked at, you know, like that, or like I was like a drug dealer or that my kids were in danger. And, you know, they kind of were, you know, in danger, but I didn't realize that at the time. Mm-hmm. You've heard me. There's so many crazy stories and we had so much fun. We had such a fun time for the times that we did enjoy with each other. Some of my best stories and everything is with him. And so I don't regret it by any means, but.
Well, you shouldn't. I mean, that's a time in your life. That's an experience. And sadly, there's a lot of lessons learned for you. And I hate the fact that you feel ashamed. My brother passed away from people say a drug overdose, but he actually had a bad mix of prescription drugs. And he wasn't exactly abusing them, although he was a drug user and abuser most of his life.
Yeah.
But at the end, he ended up having a brain aneurysm and dying.
Oh, no.
People are like, oh, where's your brother at? And I feel that sense of shame, like he died from drugs. You know, he died in 2004. It's been over 10 years, and I don't feel that embarrassment or shame anymore about it. And I, if nothing else from this podcast, I want people to know that there are more and more people that are affected by death, by murder, and people being incarcerated. It shouldn't be so taboo or so shameful because it's actually just a part of life, and we just choose not to look at it.
And a lot of people have it. When you start, like, you know, you and I have been on like blabs or stuff where you bring it up, and people, like someone else we knew, was like, "Oh well, my brother was shot by the police."
Yeah,
there's all these things that people don't realize, or like maybe how you were raised. Like I was raised in a really broken family, and I didn't know what was right from wrong, you know, or what love really is. If you have parents that abuse you, you don't really know. You're just kind of mixed up, you know, as to what is really straight in your mind. And I think from this, I really learned, first of all, with my kids, what kind of life I want them to have. And I've worked my butt off, right, to make sure that they have this good, solid life. And they do now. It's really sad when I have to tell them, you know, about these things, but they're tough. I'm sorry for bawling.
Oh, you're fine. I think you're the first guest we've had cry on the show, but that's
really
okay.
And it's funny because I don't cry often. No. Like even when I talk about him, I don't. I'm pretty good at containing it, but I think it's when I get down to the fact he was a person.
Thank you so much for coming on, Samantha. I'll talk to you soon. And it was very brave to share your story. And hopefully your story will give other people strength in things that they have to go through in their lives.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.